You're listening to The Globalist, first broadcast on the 19th of April 2024 on Monocle Radio. The Globalist, in association with UBS. It's 1400 in Beijing, 8am in Milan, 7am here at Midori House in London, and 2am in Washington, DC. You're listening to Monocle Radio. The Globalist starts now. Live from London, this is The Globalist with me, Emma Nelson. A very warm welcome to today's programme. Coming up, Israel attacks Iran, with explosions heard near to an army base in the central city of Isfahan. We'll have the latest. Also coming up, will the block on US money for Ukraine finally be lifted? The House heads for a vote that Kiev says could make the difference between victory and defeat against Russia. Plus,
the more you get to know people and genuinely create a bond and a friendship and are sharing tables together and meals together, then suddenly doors start opening.
We're at Milan's Salone del Mobile to hear about craft and design in the city. We'll get the newspapers from Paris, and then
we learned that Truss's book, surely the only prime ministerial memoir to have been longer in the writing than its author was in office, is entitled 10 Years to Save the West.
Andrew Muller will tell us what we learned this week, and Will Hodgkinson will give us his verdict on Taylor Swift's new album. That's all ahead on The Globalist, live from London. And let's begin with some breaking news that's happened overnight. There are reports that Israel has launched a missile strike on Iran. Let's get the latest now from our US editor, Chris Lord. He's been monitoring the situation over the night from the United States. He joins us on the line from Los Angeles. A very good evening to you, Chris.
Good to be with you, Emma.
So what can you tell us?
So lots of different conflicting reports out there right now. Let's just break it down a little bit about what we know and what various different players in this are saying. So at around dawn, Tehran time, reports started to emerge that US officials had told several US news outlets that an Israeli missile had hit Iran. In the wake of that, you then had quite quickly Iranian media reporting that drones came into Iranian airspace, that the Iranian air defense system was activated, shot the drones down, and there were explosions around the central city of Isfahan. Now, we don't actually know exactly what's gone on. The IDF, the Israeli Defense Force, have actually explicitly said no comment, that the PM, Benjamin Netanyahu, will not be commenting on it right now about exactly what has happened. But between the two things, what we can say here is that there was some kind of Israeli-launched attack in some way onto Iranian positions within Iran. The fact that it's around Isfahan is where we can sort of start to join these dots is very interesting. There are large nuclear sites around Isfahan. Everybody is saying right now that those nuclear sites have not been hit, so this is not what's happening. However, the air defense system, it appears, has been activated. And I think what's now being picked through is how effective that Iranian air defense system was. What has happened here, if as these various players are saying, is as what's unfolded, is that this is a retaliation to what we saw at the weekend, where Iran launched a pretty unprecedented large-scale barrage of attacks against Israel with drones and so on into Israeli airspace, which was quickly fought off. Israel swore it would act in some way. Despite the warnings of the US and others to say, you know, as Joe Biden famously said to Netanyahu, he said, you know, take the win. You've shown that you can hold off against Iran. Do not respond, and so on. It seems that from all we're hearing overnight, Emma, is that Israel has decided to act and in some kind of retaliation.
The interesting thing here is that we're not quite sure about what the level of this retaliation is, are we? And that's the key, isn't it? Because Iran had, the moment that it launched its missile attack on Israel, said, right, that's it, we're drawing a line under the whole affair. Israel had different ideas. And it is the scale of the attack which arguably will determine just how much further this thing goes.
There are two takeaways, I think, from this. I think the first, as you say, you know, Iran sort of had said, let's draw a line under it. And Israel, if you look throughout its history, never allows any attack of any form, whatever that might be, to go unresponded to, if you will. They will always act in some way of retaliation if they feel threatened. And so lots of people who were observing this said it's only a matter of time before Israel will do something, despite the warnings of the White House and so on, to sort of be measured. They will do something here to retaliate what happened at the weekend. I think what we can take here, if we're just taking the basic truths that we can deduce here, that there has been some kind of attack, that the Iranian air defense system has activated, and yet there have been explosions around the city of Isfahan. If we just take that as what we can piece together from what we know, then what that says to me is that actually the aerial defense systems of Iran are not as good, first of all, as Israel's, where, as we saw over the weekend, the Iron Dome and Israel's partners managed to defend against those drone attacks. It shows, to some extent, a little bit some of the weakness of the air defense system there in Iran. And I think also it begs the question now of what's going to happen in this tit-for-tat next. What is Israel going to do? What is Iran going to do now in response to this incursion into its airspace, into this attack? What's that going to look like? Is it going to come from Iran again, from within its own borders? Is it going to be a proxy attack from Hezbollah or the Houthis and so on, one of its various sort of militia groups that it supports around the Middle East? And I think also it kind of begs that question of what Israel is going to do now. Is it going to sort of own this event that's happened, and as various sources are saying, is that they have made this attack? Are they going to own that, or are they going to keep this sort of strategic distance from it in the next 24 hours? I think that there is a fundamental question here about who's going to bring this to a stop, because the tit for tat doesn't seem to be stopping. And similarly, we can also say there is something very pointedly important, I think, about explosions outside the city of Isfahan. Israel has shown its might, and it's not afraid to do it. And now the question is, are all those regional partners, the likes of Jordan and so on, the Arab countries around Israel, who stepped in over the weekend to support Israel and to fend off those Iranian attacks onto Israeli airspace, are they going to do the same thing now that Israel has retaliated? I think that's going to be the question in the next few days, Anna.
Chris, thank you very much indeed. Well, listening to that was the Iranian journalist, broadcaster and former presenter at the BBC's Persian service, Negin Shiraghi. A very good morning to you, Negin.
Good morning, Emma.
So what do we think that Iran is going to do next?
It's really difficult to answer. But right now, from the chatter and from the pattern of behaviour, we might be able to say there is no interest in escalating to a full war right now. It's all of the Iranian media are controlled by the government. And since the attack last week, even the social media became completely controlled. If you post anything that is going against the regime, they can arrest you. So understanding exactly what are the different types of views within the government and outside the government, it's almost impossible right now. But at the same time, they've been downplaying the attack, and they haven't created, like, they look at it as a failure right now. And they're saying it was small drones, they didn't do any damage, and in completely trying to calm down the situation. And I think from that we can say, and from the pattern of behavior, that for Iran, with the situation that it is in, especially economic situation and other problems that it has inside the country, there's no interest in full-on war right now. They're going to drag the tension, and that's in their interest, to play with their proxies in the region, to poke here and there and make the tension rising. But I think that's a long-term plan, not the quick response.
And as we heard from Chris Lord a moment ago, the reports of what happened overnight suggests that the aerial defence systems of Iran are certainly not as good as Israel's. I mean, how vulnerable is Iran here?
The interesting thing is, this area, the Isfahan that was attacked, it's not the first time Israelis attacked to that area. There are incidents of attack throughout years. And the interesting thing is to understand exactly what happened today, because it seems like every time the attacks are targeting more directly different parts of the military equipments or the bases that are around that area. And if this time, I just read an article on Washington Post that was claiming the Israelis send a signal to the Iranians that if we want to attack your nuclear facilities, we can by this attack. And so, and then the Iranians are saying, these are like really small drones. We managed it really easily. There's like no problem and all of it. And from that denial, you can kind of read between the lines that Israelis might have sent a stronger signal that we are seeing right now, that they can attack the nuclear facilities if they want to. And they send a strong signal to the Iranians to stop escalating otherwise we're going to attack. Although I do believe that it's in interest of both countries to, both governments, not the countries, both governments to not escalate more than this right now, because both of these governments got what they wanted from this tension. Netanyahu is, got the support inside and outside Israel. Also the Iranian regime managed to crack down inside the country because, there's a police state right now in the country.
Indeed, tell us a little bit more about how Iranians are reacting to what's going on.
So the Islamic Republic, the government, it's interesting. So from the consulate attack, it seems like there was a plan on how to respond to it. The attack to Israel on Saturday was completely planned. They sent a message to the American and Israelis that we are going to attack, so be prepared. And at the same time, inside the country, they started this big new project on attacking, on cracking down on women who are disobeying the government and not wearing mandatory hijab. So on Saturday morning, the police state in all around the country was in place. The police vans were arresting women. A lot of violent scenes came out, so that fear and police state was in place. And then overnight, they attacked. Right now, it's really difficult to understand, what exactly is happening. They managed to control the flow of information in a way that they never managed to do before up to this point, especially with the social media. You know, you get the post, someone posts something. But even for this attack, we got some pictures from, the Isfahan, some UGCs, user-generated pictures, but it's really limited. And that begs the question that how much they have control over the flow of information right now, and what is the real picture inside the country?
Tell me, finally, Negin, about the wider position of Iran and its partners within the region. As we heard from Chris a little earlier on, we are now looking at the likes of Jordan and the US and France and the UK who intervened when Iran launched its drone and missile attack on Saturday night. What are Iran's partners now saying about what needs to be done next?
Iran's partner mostly are not states, so it's smaller groups and military groups, proxies. And I think there is in all of these equations, we shouldn't forget the economical situation of Iran. So we've heard around the news round of sanctions. The economy of the country is in danger. And all of these proxies are relying on money to be able to carry out the attacks they want to do. So I think it's not easy for Iran, for those groups to just operate on their own. They need the weaponry and, the consulate and the money the Iranians are sending them. And I don't think anyone is ready to react in the way that we are worried right now about. But I think at the same time, Iran is counting on Israel attacks on Gaza and the Palestinian people. And that's going to create a kind of atmosphere that Iran can use in its own advantage, because a lot of people in the Arab countries are really dissatisfied with the way their countries are responding to the Israeli attack on Gaza. And Iran is counting on banking on that and use that later on in response to Israel. And if it comes to it, they can create a kind of destabilities across the region.
Negin Shiragayi, thank you so much as ever for joining us on Monocle Radio. You're listening to The Globalist. 7:15 here in London. It's 2:15 a.m. If you're a night owl in Washington, D.C., which is where we head next, because a new aid bill for Ukraine makes its way through the U.S. House of Representatives this weekend, with members expected to vote on a support package that Kyiv says is vital if Ukraine is to win against its Russian invaders. Well, Mike Johnson, the Republican Speaker of the House and ally of Donald Trump, has told fellow party members earlier this week that he would publish draft legislation on three bills with additional military funding for Israel, Taiwan and Ukraine. To tell us more, I'm joined by Julie Norman, lecturer in politics and international relations at UCL and co-director of the UCL Centre on US Politics. Good morning. Welcome back, Julie.
Good morning.
Just explain to us why we are here again. Just remind us and remind us why things keep being blocked when it comes to the US deciding whether it wants to send help to Ukraine.
Sure. So several months ago, the U.S. Senate approved a comprehensive foreign aid bill that would provide aid to Israel, to Ukraine, and also to partners in the Indo-Pacific. That did not come up to a vote in the House of Representatives, which is controlled by the Republican Party. And that's largely because the Republican Party is very split on foreign aid. Most members support aid to Israel. Many members oppose aid to Ukraine. Some of those members oppose aid to Ukraine to the extent that they have threatened to oust their own speaker from his position if he brings a bill for aid to Ukraine up to the floor. So that speaker, Mike Johnson, has pretty much tried to delay on having this vote for as long as possible. But this past weekend with the Iranian strikes on Iran, it really did push this to a new sense of urgency. Obviously, we've been hearing urgent cries from Ukraine as well. So those bills now are coming to the floor, but as separate bills rather than as one comprehensive package.
And what difference does that make in terms of whether they'll get through or not?
Yeah, so this is the big question this weekend. And I do think that it will most likely prove to be a smart move. We know that, again, many within the Republican Party in the House would have sought to vote against Ukraine aid while still voting for aid for Israel, while many in the Democratic Party in the House wanted to support aid for Ukraine, but not aid for Israel. So in this way, it allows for these bills to potentially go through with bipartisan support, with different parties kind of carrying the weight for different parts of the aid. And if these do go through, the Senate looks like they'll pick them up collectively, and Biden has suggested he'll sign them as one collective package.
There have been repeated warnings from Ukraine that without this money, Ukraine could fail in its defense against Russia. How aware and how receptive are those in power in the U.S. House of Representatives to those pleas?
You know, I think it's become more clear to at least some in the House. And we, of course, saw the UK's own David Cameron in Washington just a week or two ago trying to drive home this point. And I would point out that many in the Republican Party still do strongly support aid for Ukraine. And that includes many in leadership positions, the head of the Foreign Affairs Committee, the head of the Armed Services Committee, the head of the Intelligence Committee. So those most involved with foreign affairs are saying to their colleagues, look, this is important, not only for Ukraine and not only for Europe, but for U.S. security as well. And that's the message they've been trying to get across to get a few more votes for that part of the aid.
Tell us a little bit more about, on a sort of slightly different note, that the fact that they have chopped up these aid packages into different parcels. Given the nature of what is now going on in the Middle East, and given the fact that Joe Biden has been trying to soothe things and calm things down, especially when it comes to Israel's reaction to Iran, has that changed the approach as to how much aid that America is now willing to give to Israel, or are questions being asked here?
Yeah, so I would say questions were probably being asked more prior to the strikes from this last weekend, when many, especially many Democrats, were really pushing to actually condition some of the aid to Israel, maybe to lessen it. Instead, what we've seen in this bill is a similar amount to what was contained in the Senate bill from a few months ago. It's about 25 or 26 billion to Israel. Some of that would be replenishing some of the defensive capabilities that we saw in operation this last weekend, like Iron Dome. Others would be for more traditional military sales. So I would say it's a mix, but it's not looking that different, I think, from what it looked like before. But I do think that sense of political conversation about conditioning aid has certainly been dampened since last weekend's events.
And internally, within the the lawmaking processes of the United States. We are looking at another speaker who could possibly find himself being defenestrated by his own kind. I mean, political risk for Speaker Mike Johnson is he's got white ring. He's got opponents within his party who will say that they will eject him if he allows a vote on the aid. And Johnson is expected to need the Democrats to bolster him along if any of these votes are to go through. I mean, what is likely to happen internally?
Yeah, so listeners are probably aware of Marjorie Taylor Greene, who's a very outspoken member from the far right part of the Republican Party, who has pretty much promised to try and oust Johnson after this vote, though she hasn't made that motion yet. And I will say, to give credit where credit is due, you know, Johnson has been pretty straightforward this last week in saying, look, I know this might come at personal cost to me, but I think this is the right thing to do. And we're here to do a job and we need to try and do it. And so I think he knows what's at stake, but you can't, I think his position is you can't let yourself be held hostage by a couple members of your party. So it's unclear where that's going to go. Obviously, in an election year, the Republicans, doesn't look good for them to have another speaker crisis. So I think there might be some attempts to prevent that. But you never know with that part of the party that likes to be disruptors.
Julie Norman, thank you as ever for joining us on Monocle Radio. Still to come on today's program.
The starting point was this amazing mosaic that was found on the ground of this palazzo in Milan, Palazzo Belgioioso. It was like on a mood board, and it was this wonderful mosaic of a sun that was done in the 15th, 16th century. And I knew I wanted to do just an uplifting, bright, kind of simple homeware collection.
We're back at Salone del Mobile in Milan. Stay with us on The Globalist.
UBS has over 900 investment analysts from over 100 different countries.
Over 900 of the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in the world of finance today.
To find out how we could help you,
contact us at ubs.com.
Let's continue now with today's newspapers on Monocle Radio. Joining me now is Agnès Parier, journalist and author of Notre Dame, The Soul of France. A very good morning to you, Agnès.
Good morning.
Tell us how Paris is this morning.
Well,
how does it feel? Have we got spring
let
yet?
Let me get closer to the window. Actually, it's grey. It's grey, it's cold, white clouds. No, it's not interesting this morning.
Excellent. You've made it sound interesting, though. So thank you so much for doing that, for taking the little trip to the window for us. Please return to your papers. Pick them up and tell us what you found.
So, bad news for President Macron. You know, we talk about the Olympic Games, and presumably the president is hoping on a positive effect on the country, but also on his ratings. But it's not going to happen on time for him, whose political party, Renaissance, is plummeting in the polls for the European elections that are taking place on June the 9th. And Le Parisien this morning has the details, and it's really not pretty. Of course, I mean, that was expected. On the far right, Marine Le Pen's party, led by the 28-year-old Jordan Bardella, is reaching new heights above the 30% mark. So it is polling at 32.5% of intended votes. And it is the highest ever lead, with 15 points ahead of Renaissance, led by somebody who's quite unknown in France. She's an MEP, 38. Her name is Valérie Ayer, and she hasn't made much of a big impression yet. And she's polling at 17.5%. But, you know, bad news never come alone, as we say in French. And the Socialist Party is actually getting closer to Macron's party, only 3 points behind, thanks to, so far, a rather successful and dynamic campaign led by the French MEP, Raphaël Glucksmann, who seems to, you see, attract left-leaning Macronist voters, because, you know, Macron's party is a big chapel from centre-right to centre-left. And, it looks as if they could be tempted to vote for the socialist. And if the socialist overtook Macron's party, it would be calamitous, really, for President Macron, because, you know, those EU elections are seen like a midterm national election before the presidential elections of 2027. So such result would probably produce a series of no confidence votes in parliament, which could not only undermine the government, but, you know, why not bring it down? So probably Macron's biggest asset in this is Gabriel Attal, his prime minister, who is young and combative, but this may not prove enough. So watch this space.
How much of an asset is Gabriel Attal? I mean, can he overcome what is clearly an assault from every single political side?
Well, I would say, you know, his youth and is also intellectually very bright is really an asset. You know, he doesn't have a family. That's all he does, 24 hours a day. I mean, he's everywhere. You can see, you know, he's got so much energy. And this is what you need in the current situation. It may not prove enough, but, you know, he's got all the assets to sort of be a rampart for President Macron.
Let's move on to the story about Enrico Letta. He was our top story yesterday on Monocle Radio because he was talking about the future of the European Union. He's also got another job in his pocket at the moment. He wants to be the head of Sciences Po, one of the most respected universities in France, isn't it?
Yeah, well, that's an interesting little bit of news because, as you mentioned, he's Italy's former PM. He's a former MEP. He was minister a few times in different governments in Italy. He's also running, he's the president of the Jacques Delors Institute. But he wants to run, apparently, that French elite school that was created in 1871 after the defeat. Terrible defeat at the Franco-Prussian War. And the idea of Sciences Po was to renew the French elite. And it would be the first time, if he is successful, that a non-French national run the institution. And when you think about it, I mean, it makes perfect sense. 50% of Sciences Po students are international. They come from the US, Germany, and Italy, most importantly. And so it wouldn't feel strange in any way. And it's also something that is done in cultural institutions and museums, but not so much in elite academic. Just imagine a world where Enrico Letta is the head of Sciences Po, but Angela Merkel, the head of Harvard or Cambridge University, and a former French PM like Edouard Philippe, the head of the London School of Economics. You know, this is really what we would call a globalized elite. And thankfully, they would all be polyglot as well.
Indeed. Well, the article in Le Monde, which covers this story, begins with the saying, "Is there, you know, this is a name that transcends national borders to try to sort of calm any kind of disruption at Sciences Po." Is there a real problem with the idea of an Italian running a great French institution, or is this something that's being whipped up for nothing?
No, I think it's, you know, the guy is extremely respected. It's as if Mario Draghi, for instance, would run. I mean, they are former politicians who have a sort of intellectual baggage. They are also academics and they carry real, you know, weight and moral weight as well. Yeah, that's why I mentioned Angela Merkel. This is obviously not the case of every politician in the world, but some of them are seen, you know, perhaps more competent. And also they carry, you know, it's like cultural institutions, museums. There's something quite appealing that, you know, a true European, for instance, and a really respected figure come and run a French institution. It's a sign of, you know, straight outward looking, if you like, and openness.
Finally, let's have a look at an article in L'Express, which talks about 50 years since the death of Georges Pompidou. There's a reassessment of not just his political, but his creative legacy.
Yes, you know, the French president died while he was in power. He was only president for 4 years. He had a cancer. Nobody knew in France. There's this book that is published this week called Pompidou's Lessons or Les Leçons de Pompidou. And that's interesting because we hardly, you know, look back at Pompidou. But when we do, the guy was extremely straightforward. It was a time when, you know, there was no spin or compared to today, very little spin, very little political communication, if you'd like. So he's, you know, when you read his interviews of the time, he feels incredible, free, no jargon. And of course, Pompidou today is linked to Pompidou Center, not only in Paris, but there are Pompidou centers throughout the world. And it was a striking moment in France where, you know, he was a sort of updated classicism, you know, elegance and innovation. He was very much a modern president, and his love for contemporary art was essential for France and the Pompidou Center, which became that world center for contemporary art. And when he saw the Renzo piano design for the Pompidou Center, apparently he smiled and said, "They are going to scream." He left people being very free. You know, he would just give sort of impulses and let, you know, people being very free, like Renzo Piano, he didn't want to control anything. And, you know, during his presidency, he launched, you know, the Concorde, the high-speed train, the TGVs, nuclear facilities, Airbus. And the guy had a PhD in grammar. He was an avid reader. And I really loved, you know, plunging into that time. So I might buy the book.
It's an interesting thing, isn't it? Because what you speak of are many of the things which still define France's cultural modernity. When you talk about, you know, the way that Air France was brought up to date, and they had they had the Concorde, and then they had the TGV, and then they had the Pompidou Center, these are all things which sort of still mark out France 50 years later.
Yes, completely. And it only happened in a few years. You know, he was the prime minister of De Gaulle. And then he was succeeded by a rather modern president too, Giscard d'Estaing. But Pompidou, I mean, was, I don't know, I mean, De Gaulle is that figure in French history, a giant. Giscard d'Estaing was very much mocked at the time and still now for the way he talked, because he was an aristocrat. But Pompidou, you know, come from the Cantal region, and he's a very endearing figure who I think we will rediscover because of the anniversary of his death.
Agnès Parrier, thank you so much for joining us on the line from Paris. You're listening to Monocle Radio. This is The Globalist with me, Emma Nelson, and the time here in London is just nudging 7:33 a.m. In a moment, we head to Milan for Salone del Mobile, but first, a quick summary of today's other news headlines. The UN has warned Israel that its commitments to improve aid access to Gaza has had either limited or nil impact. The United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres pushed for urgent, meaningful and measurable progress to avert famine. The United Nations has long complained of obstacles to getting aid in and distributing it through Gaza during the six-month-old war between Israel and Hamas. A Polish man has been arrested and charged with planning to cooperate with Russian intelligence services to aid the possible assassination of the Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky. Polish prosecutors said the man, named as Pavel K, was allegedly tasked with collecting information about an airport in Poland used by the Ukrainian president. And Kenya's military chief has died after a helicopter crashed in the west of the country. General Francis Omonde Ogola, Kenya's highest-ranking military officer, was in the helicopter alongside 11 other military personnel. Only two people survived. This is The Globalist. Stay tuned. Now, born in the United States but resident in Italy for more than two decades, JJ Martin is the founder, as well as what she calls the chief creative and spiritual officer, of the Milan-based lifestyle brand La Double G. Now, globally successful, it creates maximalist fashion and homeware, all of which made in Italy, sourcing expertise and materials everywhere from Lake Como to Murano. Well, Martin, who's a former journalist, came to our House of Switzerland studio at Salone to talk to Europe editor-at-large Ed Stocker about the success of the colourful brand.
As a child, I was always obsessed with colour and pattern and embellishment, and I never went through a minimal phase, ever. Like even during Phoebe Philo's hardcore Celine years, I mean, yeah, I would take a piece here or there, but you would never see me every day in a minimal. I used to work at Calvin Klein in New York, actually, before moving to Milan. And I was the only one there who didn't look.
You didn't adhere to the Calvin Klein dress code.
Definitely not. And I was always dressed in these crazy kind of vintage concoctions. So I think it was always inside of me. And the vintage clothes that I was attracted to were always super colorful. It was always that 1960s, 70s, the Valentino, the Saint Laurent, Oscar de la Renta in the 70s was fantastic. And I was 1960s Pucci. So I wasn't collecting Mugler or Alaya or Calvin, let's say, or Helmut Lang. And later was really interesting. As I kind of started this consciousness and spiritual path that I've been on, I started learning about energy. I learned that color has a real frequency. So I didn't realize how sensitive I was to actually the frequency and the feel-good factor of color and how much it could transform my mood, transform my thoughts. And kind of soon after understanding all of that, I made this mission statement for Double J that our motto is really raise your vibration.
Tell me about your latest collection that you're showcasing this week that I believe harnesses the power of the sun.
It sure does. So we started with, actually, the starting point was this amazing mosaic that was found on the ground of this palazzo in Milan, Palazzo Belgioioso. It was like on a mood board, and it was this wonderful mosaic of a sun that was done in the 15th, 16th century. And I knew I wanted to do just an uplifting, bright, kind of simple homeware collection. And so we just started with this idea of the sun's rays and created, as we always do, a lot of different patterns, layering of pieces. And so you've got that mosaic sun as one of the graphics and one of the images, but then there's lots of other different patterns that are meant to be mixed and matched, and it's all really warm. And then thinking about how to display it, this was the first year that we actually collaborated with an artist. His name's Max Seidentoff, and he's an incredible artist who brought this like level of, it was so fun to just see him kind of take our homeware and like throw it up in the air and like see what would, the sort of magic that would happen when it's like off the table. So he animated the plates and brought a lot of movement, a lot of joy, a lot of that fun sense of humor, which we actually do in a lot of other ways. Like we're always cracking jokes in our newsletters, and we try to be a fashion company that's not taking itself so seriously. So it was beautiful to partner with someone like him that gave us a new way of doing that, twisting it.
This week seems to be all about finding that perfect place, the incredible palazzo. I mean, where your installation is amazing, you know, the chance to go into this beautiful palazzo. But, you know, is that very important, finding this incredible building that perhaps people don't know about?
Absolutely. And that, I think, was one of the most frustrating parts when I first moved to Milan, was not understanding how to get access to all that. And I was taking, or I realized later, I was taking the American approach. Like, why can't I just go and find this? Actually, the only way you're going to get that is by building relationships with people. So that's the Italian approach. So the more you get to know people and genuinely create a bond and a friendship and are sharing tables together and meals together, then suddenly doors start opening and you start, like, suddenly someone's grandmother or like whatever has like the keys to some garden that you can't even imagine is behind someone's house. So that's kind of a very Italian mechanism, I would say.
And why do you think you're having so much success? Why do you think all this is happening? What explains why the brand, do you think, is resonating with so many people?
I think that we've got a really good, I mean, first of all, this is the thing that I'm really adamant about. We are 100% made in Italy. So this is so important to me. It drives me nuts when I see brands that have a comparable price point as we do and they're made in China. That drives me bonkers because it's just not a fairly priced product. Our margin is super fair for what the level of quality that you're getting. I mean, all of our glass is hand-blown in Murano. All the silks are made in Lake Como. I mean, it's really a very well-made product. And it's at the right price. Obviously, not everyone can afford a dress, even at this price, that is well-priced, let's say, for luxury. So I recognize that there are financial constraints, but at the same time, what I mean is, like, if you have an open heart, you are welcome to the party at Double J. And we do that through the product itself. I try to really make product that is easy and that can take you from morning, noon, night. It's practical, looks good on the body. It's made by a woman for women. I think that counts. And then I would just say, you know, in terms of that inclusivity, we really have that in our shop in Milan. So I think all of that together is like a special sauce.
That was JJ Martin talking to Ed Stocker at Salone del Mobile in Milan. You're listening to Monocle Radio. This is The Globalist.
UBS is a global financial services firm with over 150 years of heritage. Built on the unique dedication of our people, we bring fresh thinking and perspective to our work. We know that it takes a marriage of intelligence and heart to create lasting value for our clients. It's about having the right ideas, of course, but also about having one of the most accomplished systems and an unrivaled network of global experts. That's why at UBS, we pride ourselves on thinking smarter to make a real difference. Tune in to The Bulletin with UBS every week for the latest insights and opinions from UBS all around the world.
Time to talk music now. Let's hear from Will Hodgkinson. He joins us now. Very good morning to you, Will. Welcome back to Monocle Radio.
Good morning, Emma.
Good to have you with us now. I think we obviously have to dive straight into Taylor Swift's new album. And I'll say this to anybody who's listening as a podcast later. Pull up Will's review on The Times, because Will, you go through track by track in a sort of a forensic dissection of what you've given a five star rating to this album.
I have, yeah. I did two star ratings. I did a star rating for the music, you know, quality, and I did a star rating for the FBB, the former boyfriend bashing rating, because quite a few of them come in for, you know, a bit of a pasting. Joe Alwyn, the British actor who she is with for quite a long time, she seems to be genuinely heartbroken about this guy and sad that it didn't work out. Matty Healy of the 1975, who she went out with for a couple of weeks, I'm pretty sure there's a song called The Smallest Man Who Ever Lived, which is about him. So we don't really need to say any more about that. It's a reflection on love in all its forms. She's older and her fans are older. It's reflecting what's going on in their lives too. The music is more middle of the road, you know, less kind of perky pop and more Stevie Nicks Fleetwood Mac style. And it's very, very good. You know, it hits all the right notes for the star that she is, who's really, I mean, I think Taylor Swift is probably the biggest star in the world right now in the world of music.
It's an interesting approach, isn't it? Because you begin this article by saying, you know, who would be a former boyfriend of Taylor Swift, I should say. And you have a really strong point here, given the fact that if you are going to go out with Taylor Swift, it's like being lured by the song of a siren, because she will pull you in only to subsequently dash your brains out on the rocks once it all goes pear-shaped.
Oh, well, I wish I'd used that line myself. I think it's not as brutal as it might seem. I mean, one thing's going on. First of all, that every songwriter uses personal material for fuel, but they do put it through an imaginary filter. So they're, you know, these songs are, of course, they're about the things that have gone on in her life. And there's no question. There's one song called So Long London. Well, the Swifties know that there's a song a while back called London Boy, which is about the same guy, which is, you know, clearly Joe Alwyn. So obviously it's very autobiographical. But at the same time, I do think what she's trying to do is, you know, kind of write the quintessential love song, which is about, maybe it's about a fantasy, or it's about the boyfriend that's not very good, or it's the relationship that she did love the guy, but he was too, you know, too depressive or whatever. So all of these things come into it. And I think that what her great skill is doing this in a way that then the fans apply to their own lives. So, yes, it is personal. But it is also poetic. Because it's not with so much detail, you know.
It does have to be relevant to the audience, doesn't it?
Because exactly.
And does she strike that chord?
I think she does, yeah. And I think really, you know, because people are saying, why is Taylor Swift so successful? I mean, she's, in a way, she's very, very mainstream. She's not an outrageous pop star, you know. She looks normal, kind of all American, really. And I think that's essentially the key. What she does is that she represents through her own life, which is obviously nothing like ours because she's a billionaire, the same day-to-day emotions that other people go through. And that's really what she's done here. So every song is a love song of one form or another, imagined or real.
And you said that the style has changed because she does, as the best pop stars do, reinvent herself musically on each album. What is the sound with this one?
Well, it's AOR, it's electro pop, kind of 80s synth pop style. You know, it's really, I mean, and yes, you're completely right. I mean, during the lockdown, she made two kind of indie folk albums, Folklore and Evermore. Before that, there was the perky pop of, you know, Bad Blood and Shake It Off and all those big songs. So, you know, people, the fans are a little bit older. It's, yeah, to me, it reminded me of Fleetwood Mac, a bit of 80s power balladry, some sort of, you know, a sort of slight My Heart Will Go On, you know, kind of Lacrimose love ballads. A la Celine Dion, a touch of that. So yeah, it's a sort of, it's an adult, what do you call it? Adult contemporary, I guess.
Noted. Thank you, Will. Let's move on to Billie Eilish, in another enormous name, but arguably targeting a completely different audience.
Totally, totally different. I mean, she's a real Gen Z star. She's much hipper, I'd say. The interesting thing about Billie Eilish, this album's coming out in a month or so. It's called Hit Me Hard and Soft. You know, so the Taylor Swift album and all big albums now, they can make a lot of money by having lots of different vinyl editions because fans will buy them, you know, coloured editions, double album, whatever. You know, there's so many ways to do it. Billie Eilish went on record recently to say that this is very environmentally unfriendly. She's gone the other way. She's doing one version and it's on recycled vinyl, literally the, you know, the stuff that's picked up off the factory floor and you know, stuffed back into record form. And she's kind of going, I think Billie Eilish is fascinating. I mean, she's, you know, she's come out as gay, which I think was, you know, not a secret at all, but, you know, she's very much in a very different position. It's almost like she's representing a mainstream position, but for people who weren't previously mainstream. So I think she's a really fascinating character and very good songwriter. So I'm looking forward to this.
Indeed. Strangely enough, a friend of mine's six-year-old daughter finds her absolutely fascinating. We were looking at how a six-year-old would see or young women or young people today will see the likes of Billie Eilish as actually a very positive role model.
Very positive, notably not sexualized at all. And, you know, most pop stars are in one way or another. Very, very strong-willed. But sort of, I think what's so interesting about Billie Eilish is that she's totally herself. You know, she doesn't feel like she's been manufactured by anyone. And, of course, the songs are written by her and her brother. You know, her parents were very supportive. She became famous extremely young. So she's really operated in a different bubble away from the record industry machine. And she's done it, you know, to be that successful on her own terms is pretty impressive.
Now, we always love a pop temper tantrum. They're always fun. And that is arguably why pop music is so good. Blur's Damon Albarn arguably lost it at Coachella. Tell us what happened.
Well, what happened was is that he thought, and, you know, let's remember that he only played Wembley last year and everyone was singing along massively. When Blur did Girls and Boys, which is that fantastic anthem about Club 18 to 30 holidays, he expected the American audience to sing along. And, of course, they didn't. A, they probably didn't know the words because it wasn't a hit over there. And B, they're probably too busy, you know, Instagramming themselves because this is Coachella. So he got frustrated and ended up saying, I'm never going to come back here again. And, you know, there's been a little bit of controversy about it. Personally, I think it's great when pop stars act that way because they should. You know, they shouldn't be all this pandering to the audience the entire time, telling them that, you know, they love them. I think it's, you know, I think it's good that someone like Damon Albarn, who you know, and Blur are an indie band, they're not a pop sensation. You know, he got annoyed at them because he felt that, well, what's the point? You know, it's like they don't care about us. We don't care about them. This is ridiculous. The whole thing's a farce.
Well, there was that. I mean, we mentioned a moment ago the relevance to the audience. I mean, Blur hasn't really been massive in the United States, has it?
No, one song, Song 2. That's the only one that got through. And that's a kind of, you know, American football game anthem, you know, with the woohoo, which everyone will know. No, they're not. I mean, they're very British. you know, if you think about Park Life and all the big 90s anthems, it's all about British life at the time. Even now, you know, the last album, The Ballad of Darren, it's a very British reflection. And I don't think they really travelled. But then a lot of bands didn't. The Kinks didn't really travel that well. You know, so actually Oasis never really got that big in America. So, yeah, I think it was definitely a culture clash.
Finally, I mean, on that note, you mentioned the Instagram nature of Coachella. What does that say about Coachella as a festival itself?
Well, what I say about Coachella itself is that I went there once. It's got 11 different VIP areas, which you can pay to get into, depending on how much money you want to spend. And that says it all for me. You know, there's some sort of ego trip on the part of the audience at Coachella, which is just awful. I mean, it's in the middle of a desert, so you have to drive out there. Everything is incredibly expensive. It's not, for me, it's the most horrible festival in the world. So, yeah, I kind of felt that I was on the side of Damon Albarn here.
Will Hodgkinson, thank you so much, as ever, for joining us on Monocle Radio. You're listening to The Globalist.
Become a Monocle magazine subscriber today and enjoy 10% off any annual subscription. It's time to get a truly global view that's upbeat and optimistic. With a global roster of correspondents and bureau, we deliver stories that you won't find elsewhere. Expect insights on everything from diplomacy and design to art and architecture and more. Sign up today and you'll receive 10 issues and seasonal specials full of inspiration. Visit monocle.com/subscribe and enter the code RADIO10 to redeem this offer.
Finally, it's Friday, which means our contributing editor, Andrew Muller, has been busy recapping the past 7 days for us. Here he is with this week's What We Learned.
We learned this week that France is gonna France. Where's that somewhat oversold and frankly debatably tasteful Gallic outrage chorus we recorded a while back on a slow afternoon?
No, vraiment.
We learned this via the altogether and tacky wretched honey trap scandal, which has been delighting the UK's commentariat this last week or so. Flirtatious WhatsApp messages were sent to at least a dozen prominent male members of the UK's political class, several of whom replied in a fashion which suggested they had somehow persuaded themselves that this was neither prank nor blackmail, and that their diligent labours on the minutiae of fisheries reform, or whatever, had somehow inflamed the ardour of a comely stranger, possibly called Svetlana or Natasha. We learned, however, from a documentary coincidentally broadcast on French television, which is the kind of thing we watch as we are sophisticated like that, that similar outreach is never made to French intelligence operatives or public officials because there is no point.
I can't wait to see where this goes.
Okay. Tell me more.
Let's see where this goes.
We learned from the documentary that the spouses and employers of French secret agents already know or at least assume that they are insouciantly conforming to every stereotype of French lubriciousness, which has ever served as a sneering, if somewhat jealous, motif in a British sitcom, rendering French spooks effectively unblackmailable. And as if that was not indeed enough to stir any French citizen to give their accordion a patriotic squeeze, we learned or were reminded by details of an upcoming auction that pretty much the same cheery shamelessness applies to French presidents. We learned that next month the grey Piaggio three-wheeled scooter upon which then-president François Hollande escaped the Élysée Palace for trysts with his then-mistress, now-wife, is going under the hammer, not literally, that would be ridiculous, with bids starting at €10,000. We learned from reading the auctioneer's copy, possibly written after an absolutely outstanding lunch, that they are literally pitching this runabout as the 21st century equivalent of the steeds of Napoleon and de Gaulle, but sticking with the theme of European nations realizing their decline, we learned that the review copies were in of the new book by
No, don't. No,
no, no.
Please don't.
Please
don't.
They talked about ferrets so much that I was not even able to speak.
Extremely former UK Prime Minister Liz Truss caught there in a clip we are playing out of context for the purposes of inviting mockery and derision. We learned that Truss's book, surely the only prime ministerial memoir to have been longer in the writing than its author was in office, is entitled 10 Years to Save the West, an admittedly snappier title than 7 Weeks to Kill the Queen, Wreck the Economy and Get Bundled Down the Stairs by My Own Party. Much of what we learned from a cursory flip through its pages was what might have been expected, i.e. that nothing was her fault, everything was everybody else's, and that her leadership of the United Kingdom to the sunlit uplands had been maliciously thwarted by those deep state guys, eager as they always are to bring down such dogged, dangerous, anti-establishment renegades as Conservative MPs, foreign secretaries and prime ministers.
Even though I've been a cabinet minister for a long period of time. I've been prime minister. I don't consider myself part of the establishment.
Which is something like Paul McCartney claiming he never saw himself as part of the Beatles. But we learned that the lettuce non-outlasting former PM had hitched her star to a new role model, specifically this guy, to whom she compares herself.
How do you react, though, when someone, you know, from your playing staff comes in and says, boss, I think you're doing this wrongly?
Good. Well, I ask him which way he thinks it should be done. We get down to it, and then we talk about it for 20 minutes, and then we decide I was right.
This guy being English footballer Brian Clough, famously sacked as manager of Leeds United after 44 tumultuous days in 1974 before, and you can see here what Truss is inviting us to contemplate, going on to win 2 European Cups with Nottingham Forest. We learned, or more gleaned really, that she thinks she'll be back, proved to have been right all along, and will be played by Michael Sheen in a future biopic. But we learned that any among the American base of paranoid hyper-conservative weirdos that Truss has recently been cultivating who attempt to procure her new book from their local library may receive more than for which they had bargained, at least according to the unerringly reliable source of Fox News.
Libraries are no longer safe in Joe Biden's America.
Do please go on.
My once favorite place to immerse myself in Dana's reading list has transformed into rowdy drug and hookup dens.
From which we learned that Fox News presenters read books. Verily, every day is a school day, etc. For Monocle Radio, I'm Andrew Mullett.
Thank you, Andrew. And that's all the time we have for today's programme. The warmest of thanks to all our guests and to the producers, Carlotta Ribello and Monica Lillis. Our researcher was George Ruskin and our studio manager was Lily Austin, with editing assistance from Steph Chungu and Flynn Simons. After the headlines, more music is on the way. The briefing's live at midday here in London and The Globalist is back at the same time on Monday. Hope you can join me for that if you can. But for now, from me, Emma Nelson, goodbye. Thank you very much for listening and have a great weekend.